This is a lecture given at St. David's Episcopal Church in Austin, Texas. Visit our website, stdave.org.
I just should have snuck out the back.
That's fine.
How are you?
Good, how are you?
Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
You guys, we are so lucky. We're so lucky that you're here.
Anytime you call me, I'm here.
So, have you met?
We're just chatting.
I mean, so you have helped here with iftar dinners, yes?
Well, a number of years now, yeah.
And you're always here to answer any questions we have, which is amazing. Which I think is amazing because we all come from the same start, right?
Yes, definitely.
Yeah. So all of that thread that weaves through all that we do is still there if we allow it to be. So thank you for continuing to weave it.
Thank you for allowing me to weave it.
Yeah. Okay, so will you tell us a little bit about yourself and
sure.
Again?
Sure, I can do that.
And I will not belabor the point. You will just say thank you for being here.
Thank you.
My tardiness.
No problem. No problem. I had good company. Good morning, everyone. I hope everybody can hear me online as well. I'm just going to walk around. Apparently, that's okay. So my name is Güner Arslan. I'm one of the founders of the Dialogue Institute, which is an educational nonprofit. We started here in Austin. We now have chapters in 6 or 7 states all around Texas, southern states mostly. And our mission, I like to summarize as finding excusing to bring people together. So once you bring them together, and especially if you provide a little food, nothing else needs to be done. The magic happens. I turned it on. You can double check it. Okay. No problem. So we started, our very first event was 20 years ago. On the first anniversary of September 11th, we did a conference titled How to Prevent Another September 11th. And the point was that we need to come together and talk to each other, because when you don't know something or somebody, it creates fear. And that fear drives people to do crazy stuff. And one of my missions since then for the past 20 years is basically go everywhere where I'm invited and talk about my faith and what it means to me. And we invite, we have events at our site to invite people from the Christian and Jewish and Hindu and all the other faiths into our place. Like a few days ago, the executive director of Catholic Charities was at our center, talk about what Catholic Charities is about. And we learned about that. So it's a dialogue that goes both ways. I think that's a quick introduction enough for the Dialogue Institute. And I've been here since 98. I came to do my PhD at UT, and I'm still here. I'm still looking for a better place to move to, but I haven't found it yet. I love Austin. I have 4 kids. One is at UT now, and hopefully we can get the other ones in there as well. 1 son and 3 daughters. So yeah, let me dive into this. So actually, before I do any slides, I'd like to start with a very important question. And I hope some of you, maybe all of you, can answer that. So the question is, what is the speed limit on Mopac? I'm serious. What is the speed limit on Mopac? 65. That kind of sounds right, as fast as you want to go, because when I drive at 65, actually, I generally drive a little above the speed limit, like at 70, and people still pass by me like crazy. So the speed limit must be 80, 85, or 90 or something. So, but most of you said it's 65. How do you know it's 65? Where does it say so? There are speed limit signs. So what you're telling me is if I want to figure out what the speed limit on a highway is, I should look at the official posted signs rather than what people are doing. Getting my point here, where I'm going? So I like to ask all of you the same thing. So don't look at the speed that people are driving who call themselves Muslims. Look at what the official sources are saying. And the official sources for us is the Quran, which I brought a copy here, and I can actually hand it out so that you just can kind of browse through it if you like, have a feel of it. And then we have volumes of books about our prophets, peace be upon him, sayings and actions, things that he approved, things he didn't approve, things he did in one way or the other way, volumes of books. Those are the two main sources. So what we should do is we should look. When we see a person do something, we should first check whether that something fits these sources. If it's not, then they are not doing it because of Islam. They are doing it despite Islam. And my lecture here is about what this book says, to the best of my understanding. Obviously, some people think it does say different things, interpretation. We have nine judges on the Supreme Court. They read the same rules, but end up with very different interpretations. Same happens to holy books, obviously. They are written hundreds of years ago. So that's kind of my one point that I'd like you to go away with here. If you don't remember anything else I'm talking about here, just remember, if you're looking at Muslims and trying to figure out what the religion is, you're basically looking at the people who are driving on moped and trying to figure out what the speed limit is. So that's one point there. So let me start with this introduction, and that's going to come to your point. We believe Islam is a continuation of the Abrahamic religion, actually that one religion that God created with the first human being. So the way we look at the world is God created the human being, Adam and Eve, and the very next generation, their sons, already went astray and started killing each other. So we are forgetful people. The human race is forgetful. So God sends a messenger, brings us to the straight path, and then we go astray. And then God sends another messenger to bring us back to the straight path, and then we go astray. And then another messenger. And this verse, I think, gives that meaning the best to me. Say we believe in God and that which has been revealed to us and that which was revealed to Abraham and Ishmael and Isaac and Jacob and the tribes, and that which was given to Moses and Jesus and the other prophets from their Lord. We make no distinction between any of them, and to him, God, we submit. And actually, that's what Muslim means, to submit. So this is verse 83 from the chapter Family of Imran. So with that, I find Muslim scholars in the history have kind of come up with a very nice summary of what the faith is about. And it's actually based on a story, one of those stories about the prophet I mentioned in the volumes of books. There's a very nice story that kind of summarizes this. So there are two, maybe you heard of the pillars of Islam or Islamic pillars. There are actually two sets of pillars. One we call the pillars of Islamic faith. These are the things that a Muslim is supposed to believe in. And then we have another set of five pillars. Those are the things that a Muslim is supposed to do. And then we're going to talk about a third concept at the end that kind of brings everything together. But what do Muslims believe in is basically these six things are required for me to call myself a Muslim. I have to believe in all of these. I have to believe that there is a God and there is one God. I have to believe in all the prophets. We just mentioned some of them by name in the previous verse. There are about 25 prophets named in the Quran. Most of them you would be familiar from the Bible. Believe in the holy scriptures. Scriptures is plural, all the holy scriptures. Because as I said, the way we look at history is God, it's the same God, keeps sending messengers and books. But then we forget it, we change the wordings, we lose it. And God sends another book and another message. Believe in the angels, and I'm going to talk about more detail in all of these. Believe in destiny, and then believe in the hereafter. We believe there is a heaven and a hell, and we are accountable for our actions in this world. And I am from where? Which organization? Dialogue Institute. So let's make this a dialogue. Any point you find something that you have to ask at that moment or don't understand, just stop me and let's do a dialogue if we can, okay? So unity of God. If I have to describe Islam in one phrase, I would say it's all about there is one God. There is no God but the God. That's actually La ilaha illallah. That's a phrase that you will hear from Muslims a lot. There is no deity but God. And you see that I use Allah there. Allah is Arabic for God. So if you go to the Middle East, find some Christian Arabs, and there are lots of them, and ask them what they call God, they will say Allah. So Allah is just the name for God in Arabic, right? And I have translated the whole verse into English, that verse that is at the top, but I left Allah as Allah. Why do you think that is? I could just say God there. And in writing, it's okay. But most Muslims, you will see, even when they speak English, and even if they speak perfect English, they will use Allah for God rather than speaking that in English. And the problem with the word God is that when I speak, it's not clear where I'm using God with a small g or God with a capital G. And what did I just say? Islam, it's all about the oneness of God. That's really the central theme here. So we want to make sure that everybody understands when I say God, I mean God, the Lord who created everything, and not the sun God or this God or that God. So that's why we prefer Allah, which doesn't have that ambiguity. When you say Allah, it means the God that created heaven and earth, everything. Okay? So Allah is He, than whom there is no other God, who knows all things, both secret and open, He most gracious, most merciful. And then I already mentioned the rest. So, next, prophets. When I say prophet, this is one of the words that I find I have to actually define before using it. When a Muslim says prophet, what they mean is a perfect human being chosen by God to represent Him on earth. And maybe given a scripture, maybe not. Maybe he's just a messenger. There are kind of two classes we have. Some of them receive revelation in terms of like books or pages. Some of them don't. They're all perfect human beings chosen by God. We believe they don't. They are sinless. They are protected by God from committing sins. And this is the highest pinnacle a human being can achieve. And as I said, Muslims believe in all the biblical prophets, including Adam, Noah, Moses, Jesus, Muhammad. We already mentioned them in the previous verse. There are 25 prophets named in the Quran. Muhammad, we believe, peace be upon him, is the last and final prophet. There are some seats. Help yourselves. He was born in 571, died in 632. He received the first revelation when he was age 40, and the revelation lasted 23 years until his death. And what you're seeing in the Quran is basically those revelations that came over 23 years compiled into a book. Muhammad is different from most of the other prophets. Most of the biblical prophets come from the lineage of Isaac, Abraham's son. Muhammad comes from the lineage of Ishmael, his other son. And you're familiar with the story. So that's prophets. So we mentioned God, oneness and existence and oneness of God we believe in. We believe in all the prophets. So you cannot be a Muslim saying, I believe in all the prophets, but Moses, I have a problem with. No, that doesn't work. Holy Scriptures, again, the Talmud, the Psalms, the Torah, the New Testament, the Quran, we believe they are all God's message. We also believe that all of these, except the Quran, at this point, we don't have the original anymore. And that's why God sent us the Quran. And we believe the Quran, every word is in the Arabic form, is chosen by God. So when we do our prayers, we recite them in Arabic in the original form. We have translations, and what I'm passing around there, there should be a Quran somewhere. What I'm passing around is has the English translation in it, but that translation might change over time, right? I mean, as we discover new things. For example, a very nice example is the word they used to translate as a mustard seed, a small seed. Now they translate as an atom, because they didn't know 1,000 years ago what an atom was. But when they read it now, they, oh, this is referring to an atom. Now we know what it is, so we're going to translate it as an atom. Yes. Sorry about my accent. Please ask if it's not clear. And again, we believe in the original form, all these scriptures are from God. And actually, the way, if you read the Quran, the way the Quran is worded, it will refer to the old scriptures, not saying this verse, this chapter, but it, for example, it will say, remember the story of Abraham, where he did this and that, and leaves it with that, and then goes to the lesson from that we need to take from that story directly, leaving the story, the meat of the story, for us to learn from you guys, from Christians and Jews, and from your books, basically. So there's lots of reference, and there's lots of gaps in the stories in the Quran, because we already know them. You already know that. And this is just the next version of the same book, if you will. So the assumption is that you already mastered the previous versions or releases of this book, and this is the last version. Does that make sense? Yes, ma'am. The New Testament, yeah, it is. So the New Testament, when I say New Testament, I mean Jesus received a book. We know that from the Quran, that Jesus received a book. Well, whether you call it the Bible, the New Testament, I don't know what exactly you would call it. The Gospels, maybe that's the best, better word. But we know that they don't exist in the original form anymore. So when we read those Gospels, we basically filter it with the filter of the Quran. So if something is contradicting the Quran, we will say, hey, maybe we should not take this word to word. But if there is something in the Bible, really the entire Bible, that's not contradicting the Quran, then yeah, that might be a word of God. So let's be careful with it. And the Quran was revealed to the prophet via angel Gabriel. So Gabriel will come to the prophet. The very first one, the very first revelation, Muhammad was in a cave, little outside of Mecca, and he was going there on a regular basis, spending days at a time meditating there. And this one time, he sees this being, and that being just hugs him, if you will, and just compresses him. He thought he's gonna die at that point. And then after that squeeze for a few times, that being says, recite. And Prophet Muhammad is actually illiterate. He doesn't know how to read. So he's and there's nothing to read anyway. What am I supposed to read? And then the angel says, recite. Same response. And then eventually, in the third try, he says, recite in the name of your Lord. And that's the very first verse that we have in the Quran at this point. So that's how the revelation starts. And from that point on, the revelation might come suddenly while he's just sitting there. Something comes and he generally sweats and kind of goes into trance. sometimes some event happens and humanity needs, or those people need some guidance, and God sends a verse basically explaining what they should do in that particular situation. For those verses, if you read them in the Quran, sometimes they don't make sense. You have to kind of know the backstory as well, when and why that particular verse came down. But at the end, we have a compilation of all the verses. And again, every word in that, in the original Arabic, is chosen by God. And the main theme is unity of God, as I mentioned. There are lots of stories of peoples and prophets, very similar to the Bible. Resurrection and hereafter, lots of references. And then prayer and worship. And then, as I mentioned, the secondary source we use for something that we cannot find in the Quran, or secondary source, is those compilation of books about what the prophet did and did not do in certain situation. There are stories about how he eat, how he drank water, how he brushed his teeth, how he slept. Everything is detailed. So, and for Muslims, doing things the way he does, you know, you have that nice saying, what would Jesus do? We basically say, how would Jesus do this? How would Muhammad do this? Same thing. Angels. You have to believe in angels. And we believe angels are beings made of light. They don't have a gender. And unlike human beings, they do not have a free will. So they are, they have to obey God's instructions. And this is kind of a little tricky to explain, but they help God. God doesn't need any help. Obviously, God is omnipotent. God can do everything and anything. He just says, be, and it is. That's a verse from the Quran. One of my favorite parts, actually. It just gives me the goosebumps every time I say it. He says, be, and it is. Why would he need angels? I think angels help us a little better because we just cannot grasp that be, it is. It's like, what is this, magic? And we believe that there are countless angels. That picture there is supposed to represent rain. We believe there is a prophetic tradition that says when it rains, every single drop is brought down by an angel. So every single drop you see, if think about just one angel attached to that. So everything in the universe is run by angels in that sense, by God's command. We believe in four archangels: Michael, Gabriel, Azrael, and Israfel. Azrael is the angel of death. Israfel is the angel that's going to blow the trumpet on the last day. Gabriel is the messenger angel. And, you know, Michael, right? And there are countless other angels. Destiny. Okay, we can spend. Yes, ma'am. Yeah, that fallen angel story, right? So we actually have a very similar. In the Islamic tradition, Satan, or Lucifer, whatever you call him, is not an angel. He is actually what we call a jinn, which is a separate race, if you will, made of light. He was among the angels and worshiping God with the angels, but he was a separate being which actually had free will. And the story goes that when God decided to create the human race, the angels would actually question it. I mean, again, they have to obey, but they still have intellect. So when God said, I'm going to create a vicegerent on earth, the angels responded, are you going to create a race that's going to shed blood on earth? Even the angels knew that what we're going to end up as. But God said, I know what you don't know. I'm God. You're my creation. The one among those angels that could not get behind that was Satan or Lucifer. He was proud. He basically said, hey, you created me from smokeless fire, and this being that you call a human being is created of mud. I'm superior to it. So he's the original racist. Right? I mean, he's basically just using racism there. I'm created better than that human being. And that's why he was cast out of heaven, and he was given time until the end of time. And he swore to God, I will kind of misguide all the people and you will see what they are made of. That's kind of, and then God said, you have the time, try your best. So that's kind of how the story with Satan goes in Islamic tradition. Destiny, again, this is hard to explain, but we believe there is only one creator, right? Again, central theme, there is only one God. We don't believe in duality. There is not such another force that creates evil. If there is something created, it's created by God. So then how do you reconcile God, the most merciful, the most compassionate, creating all the evil? Well, that's the consequence of him giving us free will. If we have free will, and we do, according to our teachings, that's why we're going to be responsible, and that's why heaven and hell makes sense. If we have free will, and if you think about it, we are so limited. We have to breathe every so often. We have to drink every so often. We have to eat every so often. We cannot just say, hey, I'm not going to obey the law of gravity today. I'm just going to float to work today. We are very limited with all these physical limitations. But then when it comes to one thing, choosing between good and evil, can you just imagine the range? Imagine the worst of the worst people who tortured and kills millions of people at a time. And then there, the other end, most of these prophets and holy people, the saints, who selflessly help millions of people maybe sometimes. So that range seems very wide and it's open. You can choose. God says you can pick. I mean, I'll create the evil if you will that evil. If you want to commit evil, I will create it for you. But if you want to create good, I will create that evil, that good for you too. So if you raise your hand, you can raise your hand to say hello, everyone, or you can raise your hand to hit someone. That raising of the hand, we believe, is created by God, because everything is created by God, and God is constantly creating. We don't believe in a clock type of universe where God set it up and then just watches it from outside. God is constantly creating. Again, think about the angels. Every raindrop is, God says, one drop here, please, and the angels bring it and drop it there. And it's not beyond God, right? I have a friend who is a good scholar of Islam. He always gives this example. For God, everything is easy as one thing. So it's as easy as imagining it. Can everybody imagine a watermelon right now? Was it hard? If you have seen a watermelon before, not that hard. Now imagine a whole field of watermelon with thousands of watermelons. Can you imagine it? Was it more difficult than imagining one watermelon? No? So for God, that's the same. For God, creating one thing or taking care of one human being or taking care of the whole race of human beings beyond time, like all of humans at all times, the whole universe, every single atom, it's the same thing. For him, it's as easy as we imagine watermelons. We can imagine as many of them. It doesn't make it any more difficult. So there is only one creator. He creates it, what we choose. We have freedom to choose. Whatever we choose, he creates. I mean, he doesn't have to create, obviously. I mean, he often does, but maybe he doesn't create all the evil we think, right? I mean, he's not limited by, or it's not like we are controlling him at that point, right? That's where that would go if you keep going that way. There's this concept, right? People are, well, is there predestination? Well, there is predestination in the sense that God knows everything that you're going to ask for because he's beyond time and space. So he knows what decisions I'm going to make for my life. He knows every decision that every human being ever going to live is going to make. So in that sense, everything is predestined because he knows. But it's not predestined and we just follow the script. We actually make that decision. We have free will, if that kind of makes sense. This is a hard topic. We can dive into it and get lost in it. I think when I discuss this with my Christian friends, they have similar difficulty with some of these concepts. Moving on, or not? I think it doesn't work. Did I do something? Yeah, that generally fixes it, right? Just, yeah, did I do something?
Unplug the USB.
Oh, the whole thing is closed actually. Oh, no. So while you do that, I'm going to talk about the hereafter. So the hereafter, we believe that this life is very short. One of those stories that I mentioned in that collection of books, they ask Prophet Muhammad, actually, Prophet Muhammad tells his followers this story where he says a person dies, and in the hereafter, angels ask this person who just died, how long did you live? And the person says, it was very short. It was like a blink of an eye. Before I could figure out what's going on, I ended up here. And after telling the story, the Prophet Muhammad says to his followers, you know what? In reality, it's actually even shorter than that. So even that blink of an eye description was too long, according to Prophet Muhammad. And if you think about eternal life, well, yeah, then this life is zero, right? Any mathematicians here? Compared to infinity, doesn't matter how long you live, even if you live 950 years, we believe Noah lived 950 years, even that is a tiny amount. I'll try it once I'm done with the slide. We believe in eternal life. We believe in heaven and hell. Actually, one of the reasonings we believe in the hereafter, I'm an engineer from background, so I like logical explanations, even if it's in the matter of fate, sometimes that doesn't work, but when it works for me. Scholars argue that there has to be an afterlife because we believe, if you believe in a just God, and then you see the world and all the injustice that happens here that never gets settled, then the only way you can reconcile these two things is to have a hereafter where justice is served. Right? So if either God is not just, in which case, yeah, people die and it's over. Or if God is just, either we have to have justice here before we die, or there must be some other place where this justice is served. Yes, ma'am.
Yeah.
Yes, we believe in grace, and we believe that nobody can save himself or herself with actions and belief only. It's God's grace that saves us. But to achieve God's grace, we are supposed to believe in all these things. And then I'm going to talk about the actions. Action is very important. They complement in Islam. It's not just believing. So just because I believed, I cannot be saved. I have to also do. And hopefully God will bestow his grace on us and we will be saved. You have a question too? This is all speculation at this point, right? We are speculating about things that we don't know, but the best we can extract from all the sources we have is there is the concept that if you're a believer, if you believe in God, but you committed lots of sins, you might end up in hell. And then once you serve your punishment, you will go back to heaven. There is that concept. Maybe that answers your question. There is the concept of purgatory. There is a concept of being in your grave until the day of judgment. And the grave will be either like a paradise for you or close to hell, depending on how you lived your life. So. Similar concepts, I think. So, six things that Muslims must believe in. We just covered them all. So, if somebody says, I'm a Muslim, these are the things that every Muslim, doesn't matter from what school, what sect, from what country, what language, what race, they believe in these. And then there are five things that once you believe in those things that you should put into action. There are five pillars of Islamic deeds. And that's what, the first one is a testimony of faith, the five daily prayers, almsgiving, fasting, and pilgrimage. I'm going to quickly go over them. I'm running out of time. Testimony of faith is basically just stating that there is no deity but God and Muhammad is the messenger of God. In Arabic, we generally prefer people say this in Arabic. So every Muslim has at least said this once in a lifetime. And if somebody decides to become Muslim, this is it. Once you believe this and say this, you're Muslim. There's nothing else. There's no ceremony. There's no going to an imam or visiting a certain place. Once you say there is no deity but God and Muhammad is the messenger of God, and you believe it in your heart, you're Muslim, according to Islam. أشهد أن لا إله إلا الله وأشهد أن محمدا عبده ورسوله. Who asked that? Okay, sure. The five daily prayers. So we have, you probably have seen Muslims praying on TV. Most of them are wrong. I mean, it looks like somebody just watched somebody praying and then whatever they remember, they said, okay, just do this. Or they're actually very specific, very set. This is taught, again, it's not in the Quran. The Quran just says pray. And some of the times are specified, but the Prophet Muhammad has taught us specific ways of praying. And this is prescribed. What direction you face, which is Mecca. So in the US is northeast. That's actually the closest way to get to Mecca from here, which is counterintuitive, which threw me off when I first came. I used to pray south in Turkey, and all of a sudden you're praying northeast. How does that make sense? But once you look in the globe, it actually does make sense. I actually had to take a piece of string and put it on the globe to make sure that they're not tricking me. But you face Mecca. You do an ablution first, a ceremonial washing, and then you stand, you recite certain verses from the Quran, you bow, you prostrate, and then you get up, and that's one set. And then each prayer, all of those five daily prayers have different number of sets that you're required to do. So everything is prescribed. The only place where you kind of have a little option is you're required to recite some verses from the Quran at a certain part when you're standing. You can choose which verses you want from the Quran. And all of them you have to recite in Arabic. So again, the original Arabic is the Quran. So does that mean we don't pray in any other way? That's the one common question. We do the prescribed prayers. And after that, or really any time, we don't have clergy in Islam. We have direct connection with God. Anyone, anytime can just talk to God. It's like you have your private line to God anytime. Yes, ma'am. Mm-hmm. Very good question. Yes. So you don't have to be, it's not just for getting old. You had a knee surgery. You cannot do that. You pray sitting. If you cannot sit, you pray lying. Many of the actions that I'm called talk about, like fasting, and they have exceptions. Some of them will get you away from not performing that action, but prayer, there is no excuse. You have to do it. If you're conscious, you do the prayer. If nothing, with your eyes. You basically just pray with your eyes. This is me bowing God. And then you open your eyes, and this is me prostrating in front of you, God. So you just do that. And even if you cannot move your eyes, you do it in your mind, I guess. I don't know. But obviously, if you cannot do it, you cannot do it. Right? There are fixed times. There is one just before sun rises. So between dawn and sunrise, we do a prayer. We do one when the sun passes just the zenith point. And then we have, and when I say these are all intervals, right? When one prayer, when I say it passes in it, the midday prayer's time starts, and then you can pray it anytime until the other prayer time starts. And the other prayer time starts, there are two teachings when an object's shadow is the length of the object, or the shadow is twice the length of the object. We don't look at the sun and put sticks in the ground anymore. We have apps now, so they tell us when it's time to pray. But that's how it used to be, and that's what we're calculating, actually. We're calculating, hey, the sun is there, there's the stick, how long would the shadow be? And yeah, it's time, you can do the prayer now. There is one at evening when the sun sets, right after sunset, and then there is one at night when once this the redness after the sunset, all that goes away and becomes completely dark. That's a time for the nightly prayer. So all based on the sun. So that means in the year the prayer times change. In the winter you pray them all packed, and in the summer they are further apart. And this is a personal communion with God. You just talk to God. Yes, ma'am. Yes. That, for some reason, that's a very common question, but especially in fasting. How do you fast? Because we fast from dawn to sunset. Well, if the sun never sets, what do you do? If you live up north, well, you just pick a city on earth, your favorite city, whether you're the city for you came from, or you can pick Mecca, a holy city, and you follow whatever time they do. There is always a solution if you want to find it. So the five daily prayers, and then almsgiving. This is basically wealth tax. There was a wealth tax 1400 years ago. It's not a new concept. Like, we are talking about this now. Oh, it was kind of hot topic a couple of years ago. This is obligatory for every person who has excessive wealth. And excessive wealth means, I don't care about your home, you need that. I don't care about your main means of transportation, you need that. Think about it this way. Any wealth, any money, any stock accounts, any 401 accounts, IRAs, any wealth you have, if I take that away right now, you will not feel it. You will not change the quality of your life, right? You will still live the same life. That's excessive wealth. And 2.5% of that is taxable every year. Actually, God says 1/40 of that doesn't even belong to you. It's not yours. It's not yours to keep. It's given to you by God so that you can give it to the poor. So every year Muslims calculate how much wealth they have, excess wealth they have. They calculate 2.5% of that. And then that's the minimum they're supposed to give. And many people like to give more than that. So they just give it to the poor. And it's very strict where you can give this to. You cannot give it to UT so that they can name a building after you. That's not acceptable. You cannot give it to your parents or to your kids, to your close relative. This is, even if they're poor, this is for this is a means of distributing wealth. This is a means of closing the gap between the rich and poor. And actually, in one point in the Islamic history, they couldn't find anyone to give this tax to because of every year giving, there was no poor person left in that Arabian Peninsula. So they had to go out and find people to give this to. And I have a friend who is an engineer at IBM, a Muslim friend. He actually calculated if the richest people on earth would actually apply this, it would take a couple decades before poverty is solved. It will never happen, but we can wish, right? Fasting in Ramadan. So Ramadan is the name of a month. It's the equivalent of September, so it's the ninth month. And this month is the holiest month for us, so holiest season of the year. And in this month, we are obligated to fast. And our fast is not eating, not drinking, nothing, not smoking, nothing goes into the body, so no water, from dawn to sunset. We get up pre-dawn. It's recommended that we get up pre-dawn and eat and drink. And then you don't eat and drink until sunset. So in Texas, summers, that means 16, 17 hour long fasts. And you fast whether you work in an air conditioned place like I do, or you work in the construction at 110 degree heat. Obviously, health again comes first before you ask. If you're pregnant, if you have a health condition, if you have diabetes, I don't know, if you have some sort of, If you have a temporary illness and you cannot fast, you postpone it and you make it up later. Most people do that in the winter for some reason. And if you have a chronic disease, you know that this is not going to improve. So then you can feed one person for one day. So just give one person enough money or food to last them throughout one day. That makes up for one day's worth of fast for you. It's kind of paying your debt in a different form. Yes, ma'am. I mean, the first few days are not fun, but 2-3 days, your body adapts. It's we are not really doing something crazy. It sounds crazy, but it's not crazy. You still have two meals, right? And actually, that meal that we have at sunset, and we have been doing it here at your church for the past few years as well. Before the pandemic, we started doing it at, I think our record was 45 different churches in 30 days. So half the time we had two of them in parallel. I liken that dinner, normally what we would invite family and friend over. Every day you are with somebody or somebody is in your house. It's like Thanksgiving. The only difference is you do it 30 days in a row. So what would happen if you had Thanksgiving 30 days in a row? Most people would gain weight. And that's what happens to many Muslims. And they're like, you just fasted for 30 days and you gained weight? Yeah, if you're not careful, it can happen. And it does happen. Yes, ma'am. Oh. Again, from my perspective, definitely, yes. Forget her. She's putting the baby in danger, right? So just for that purpose, I would say no, that should not be done. So pregnant women are not required to fast. But then everybody has their own thing, right? So if she somehow believes she can sustain it, there is no clear commandment not to fast. She's not required to fast. And most people would use that excuse not to fast. But there are people who go work in construction and it's 110 degrees outside and they do that and then they pass out. And apparently in some cultures, again, this is also culture, in some countries, passing out is the only way of using that excuse. So until you pass out, you don't have an excuse basically. Which is sounds very weird to me coming from a different country. In Turkey, we would not let, forget pregnant, breastfeeding. Again, you're preventing for the baby to nourish him herself because the mother cannot make enough milk without hydrating herself. So we would not let them fast. But again, it's cultural differences. So, but eating and drinking is just one aspect of fasting. The real purpose here is actually we try to train our body. Again, we believe that there is a soul in the body, and the body is just a vehicle, right? It's something that we are supposed to control. Generally, people control their vehicles, although we are going in a direction where the vehicle's becoming smart and apparently going to drive us places. But it seems like if you think about it during the day, that we're already there with our bodies. The body says, I'm hungry, and we'll start looking where the closest fridge is. We are thirsty. It says, I'm thirsty. We are looking for water. It says, I'm tired. We are looking for a place to lie down. It should be the other way. I should be controlling this body, not the body me. So in Ramadan, you kind of train yourself to get back to the normal thing, right? And for all the other things, maybe you drink too much coffee, maybe you cannot stop yourself having that snack in the afternoon, whatever it is that you cannot control with your body, in this month you learn how to control that you have to control it. So the self-control, but once you control the body, then you can start working on the real things that we need to work on, because the body is not the only things, right? Think about all the things that come to our minds that we not like to think. Maybe we feel jealousy against somebody. Maybe we don't feel compassion enough when we see a person hungry on the streets. Whatever it is, everybody knows best for themselves whatever they need to work on. That's really what we're supposed to work on. So that fasting part is kind of, hey, the body is now restrained. Don't think about that. Don't think about eating, drinking, smoking, all that stuff. Now you have extra time. Focus on improving yourself, improving your soul, really. Yes, ma'am. If you what? Then you didn't follow the rules. I mean, again, no. If in Islam there is no rule. I don't know of any rule that says, hey, if somebody don't fast, put them in jail and don't give them food and water. I mean, we live in a world where we have countries like Iran and Saudi Arabia, which have morality police, as we are learning right now from the news, right? They have, if they, I don't know what happens in one of those countries if you just eat in the middle of Ramadan during the day. I don't know whether you would be arrested or shamed, or I don't know. But back home in Turkey, nothing would happen. Maybe if there's really a very conservative person, he might look at you funny, why are you eating in front of me type of look. But even that is not actually required. That's not right, because it happened during Prophet's time. We have stories where where people were eating in front of fasting people, and somebody was not happy about it, and the Prophet said, no, let him eat. He actually is helping you to earn more deeds, because you're watching somebody eat and you're not eating just for the sake of God. So it's supposed to be actually a good thing from that perspective. But yeah, there is no enforcement. Yes, ma'am. Yes, sir. Yeah. The fast or general? So, as I said, the revelation came over 23 years, and the commandments were spread over 23 years. Some of them came, okay, now you start praying 5 times a day. And that day, everybody starts praying 5 times a day. Some are more progressive. For example, alcohol consumption was a very big deal in where this religion started in Saudi Arabia, Mecca area or Medina area. They were just drinking a lot. So first, a verse came that said, do not pray while intoxicated. So now they had to at least be sober during the prayer times, right? So that stopped drinking a bit. But then a while later, God said, don't drink. And it is said that day, the streets of the city were full with alcohol. Basically, everybody dumped the alcohol to the streets. Okay. And this is really an amazing thing. I mean, Muslim scholars would say this one person just changed this community overnight, right? In 23 years, this was a community that was drunk, that was worshiping idols, that was burying their newborn girls alive, because for some reason it was considered a shame to have baby girls. And then 20 years later, these people are looking for people they can give these alms to. And they don't drink, they don't kill, they don't... I mean, it's an amazing transformation. And it's done by this one person. And the only way that can happen, if you ask me, is with the help of God, because a man cannot do this. Does that give you some? So I'm running off time. That's why I want to finish this. So pilgrimage, once in a lifetime, we are required, every Muslim is required to go to Mecca. You remember that black cubed shaped building? That building, we believe that location is the first place where Adam, when he was sent, Adam and Eve, when they ended up on Earth, they built the first altar to pray to God. So that was the place of worship. It was lost. And then with the help of God, Abraham, you know the story where Abraham leaves Ishmael and Hagar in the middle of the desert? That's, in our story, is where Mecca is right now, because that was the first place of worship. It was the middle of the desert. There was nobody there, but God chose that place because it was the original place of worship. And then, in our story, what happens is he leaves them there, this baby and his mother, and he goes away, and Hagar, the baby starts crying and wants water. There's no water in the middle of the desert. So she runs between two hills, goes up there, looks for water there, then goes back up this hill. There's nothing there. And she apparently does that 7 times. We follow actually that footstep. That's part of our pilgrimage now. Going up and down, actually running kind of, or fast-paced walk between those hills. And at the end, what happens is Ishmael hits his foot on a place, and water gushes out from there, and that water is still flowing. It's called Zemzem, the fountain of Zemzem, and all the pilgrims who go there will bring some of that water with them and hand it out to people who have not been. I think I covered most of it. So this is how it looks. This is the largest pilgrimage. About 3 million people go there every year. And everybody is dressed the same. So you just wear 2 pieces of white cloth. Doesn't matter whether you're king of a country or a nobody. It does not matter in front of God. You're all equal. We are all equal. Doesn't matter what color of your skin is. Doesn't matter what language you speak. There, everybody's equal. Remember Malcolm X? He belonged to the Nation of Islam, which was a distorted way, a racist, black racist movement here. They called themselves Muslims, but it had nothing to do with Islam. They took some things from Islam and perverted it into a nationalist or into a racist teaching, until Malcolm X goes to pilgrimage and sees all the colored people, everybody equal, everybody together, men, women. There is no segregation. We segregate everywhere except here. Everybody is equal. And he sees that, and that transforms him. And when he comes back, he starts questioning and then basically coming back to Orthodox Islam. And now most of people who call them Nation of Islam, they're actually now on Orthodox Islam and not the original racist ideology. So I'm 5 minutes over. If you have 5 more minutes, I would like to finish that with something that brings all this together. And if you have to leave, yeah, please leave. So this is the, I mentioned Gabriel. Gabriel is the teacher. Gabriel brings all the verses to the Muhammad. But once the Prophet Muhammad and his companions are sitting, and I guess the Prophet Muhammad is teaching them, or they are discussing something, and out of nowhere comes this man who's dressed in pure white. Not a single sign of wear and tear on him, but nobody knows him, which is strange, because if it were local, then yeah, it could make sense that he's clean garb, but he's not local. So then he must have traveled from somewhere, but he doesn't have any sign of wear and tear. So people are already kind of questioning, hey, who's this guy? Then he comes and sits very close to the Prophet, so close that his knee touches the Prophet's knee. And then he starts asking questions. And then the first question is, oh, Muhammad, tell me about Islam. And then the Prophet Muhammad says, Islam is to testify there is no God but Allah, there is no God but God, and Muhammad is the messenger of God. The first thing that a Muslim must do, to establish prayer, second, to give charity, to fast in the month of Ramadan, to perform the pilgrimage to the house if one can find a way. So you have to have the means to do the pilgrimage. So these are the things that we just covered in this course. That's how Prophet Muhammad defines Islam to Gabriel, which they didn't know it's Gabriel at that point. And then this stranger says, "You have spoken truthfully." So he's asking a question and then kind of confirms it as he already knows the answer, which was another amazement again. And then he asks, "Tell me about fate. What is fate?" And fate is to believe in Allah, his angels, his books, his messengers, and the last day, and to believe in the divine decree, both its good and its evil, which is again what we have covered, the six things that a Muslim is required to believe in. And then the angel says again, "You have spoken truthfully." And then he asks a third question, which is why I'm going through this. "Tell me about excellence." And this is the word ihsan, means excellence, means doing things in a beautiful way. And then Prophet Muhammad says, "Excellence is that you worship God as if seeing him. For even if you do not see him, he clearly sees you." So you're supposed to worship like God is standing right there and watching you, and you can see him. But even if you can't do that, at least know that he can see you. I mean, we behave differently when people are around, but there is one around all the time, no matter where we are or how much we hide. He's always there, and he's always watching. So that's what he calls excellence. And so the three levels of fate, these are different levels. So the Islamic practices, the Islam is one level. So if you're practicing things, even if you don't believe anything, if you just act out, like you pray five times a day, you appear like you're fasting, from outside, I have to call you a Muslim because you're acting like a Muslim. I don't know, I cannot open your heart and check whether you have faith or not. So that's kind of the lowest level, just the external things. You do external things, you're a Muslim. Done. Then there's iman, that's faith. Now, if you believe on all the things, if you really believe what you're doing is for the sake of God, if you really believe in the angels and the God, then you have faith and you're a faithful Muslim. And then the last thing is the highest level is ihsan, the excellence, doing what is beautiful. And the idea here is that this is kind of the fruit of the other two. If you really believe in God and if you do all the actions, then hopefully that will reflect into your actions everywhere and any time. Or you can look at this as body, mind, and soul. Or you can think about this as a tree where faith is the root. You have to have that strong root to be with faith. The trunk is the deeds. And then the excellence is the fruit. And this is what Islam is all about. So that's what we're trying to accomplish, to have beautiful actions through practice of all the practices that I mentioned and by believing in all the beliefs that I mentioned. Thank you so much. Thank you. Yes, yes, how are you? Nice, oh, you go to this church?
Yes, I do.
Oh, there
yes.
We go.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Emailing with your wife.
Yes, yes. About coming to. Yes.
Yeah.
Excellent.
Thank
you. Sounds good. Thank you for having me. Thank you.
Covering. Listening to the news with
my eyes, yes. So there is a verse in the Quran that says for women to cover their heads and actually put their head coverings over their bosoms, so cover the kind of the body. That's it. And it is a commandment, but we have hundreds of commandments in the Quran. And the thing with the headscarf is it's so external, so obvious. So that's why it becomes by these people kind of a top issue. We have lots of Muslims who believe, who practice, and who do beautiful things. They don't cover their heads. I mean, it's their personal choice with respect to God. And everybody has a different background. Maybe their family was had a problem with covering their heads. In Turkey, when you see a woman from Turkey, there is equal chance they were oppressed to cover their head versus oppressed not to cover their head, which is interesting. For most Americans, one aspect is very clear. There are women who are oppressed to cover their heads. But until 15 years ago, when I first came here, there were lots of women studying here at UT because they couldn't go to university in back home, because with the headscarf, you cannot enter a university. You couldn't. Now we went all the way the other way. Yeah, pretty much, yes. During the established, Atatürk is the founder of the modern republic. He considered religion one of the factors that hold Turkey back, the Ottomans back, and that's why it collapsed. So they were trying to erase religion from public life, basically. And they followed this secularism notion that France uses, not the way we understand of separation of church and state, and faith is still strong and everywhere, and everybody talks about it. When I first came here, I was amazed. I mean, you have God written on the money. The president comes up and talks about God. That would be a big no-no, at least in Turkey 20 years ago, because, oh, how is that secular now? It's because secular, the way it's taught back home, is religion is a private thing. You do it in the mosque or at your home. Once you're outside, you cannot display anything. You cannot display, a sign of faith. You cannot wear weird beard, because that would be sign of faith for men. You cannot wear a cap. All those were signs of faith. So they have no business in public. That was kind of the things. And actually, the current government, which is an Islamist government, a radical, if you ask me, that is a backlash of that kind of oppression on religion. So it goes kind of too far either way. Yeah. Yeah, unfortunately. Thank you. Sure. Past all the requirements start at puberty, so it changes from person to person. Once they reach puberty, they are required to follow all the requirements. So fasting, praying, they become responsible. They are, in God's eye, they are adults at that age. So it changes, but what happens is kids start want to participate when they're smaller, right? So we encourage them to do that without hurting their health. So we let them get up early, pre-dawn breakfast, then they skip breakfast and they fast until noon, for example. We tell them kids' fast is ending with this call to prayer rather than the evening call to prayer. Or we give them excuses. Basically, we tell them, hey, you can have one meal, but no snacks, for example. So we find a way to accommodate them. And by the time they reach puberty, they're mostly ready to actually do it full time. But
so yeah. The app, because I lived in Saudi Arabia mm-hmm. for almost a year.
Okay.
I'm very mindful of the prayer, and I try to mind myself.
Oh, the prayer time? You're asking about the prayer time? Yes, there is an app. It changes all the time. And it's a window, time window. So normally when you hear the call to prayer, the ideal thing is to walk to the closest mosque and join the congregation. But for most of us working, it's not practical. So we find time between our meetings or sometime during that time frame, and we perform our prayers there. So it's very hard to predict when a Muslim would be praying. That's great. Thank you. Mashallah is kind of praise and yes, okay. Mashallah. Mashallah. It's something you would say when you see something nice and beautiful. And we have this concept of evil eye. I think it's also a concept in South America, maybe. We believe. Oh yeah, maybe. Where if somebody looks at something nice and wants it for him or herself or something like that, you can actually harm that person just by looking. And some people do it more strongly than other people. So this is one way of protecting against that. But in general form is when you see something beautiful, somebody doing something beautiful, is to attribute it to God. It's the beauty that comes from God. So if you see a young child do something amazing, right? Playing the piano like she's expert in it. You say, mashallah. Basically attributing that gift to the true maker of that, to God. And that has two consequences. One, you give it, you attribute the thing to the true owner, and you protect that child, because then people, you're basically reminding people, hey, it's not that child who does that. She's the vessel, and God is creating it. So don't look with envious eyes to that child. Oh, would my child do this too? Ask from God. So that's kind of protecting that child and attributing to the...
Best explanation.
Oh.
I go and an Arab, you know, anywhere on the street. Uh-huh. See them looking at it, and I say, okay, me. And many times I hear, it's very difficult to say.
You just have to explain, though.
God is great, and this is going to be a wonderful thing.
That's great. MashaAllah, you're doing a great thing. Thank you very much. Thank you. I enjoyed it.
You can find more lectures and sermons on iTunes by searching for St. David's Episcopal Church in Austin, Texas, or visit our website at saintdave.org and click on the podcast button.